On my coast, the landscape is harsh but bountiful.
Welcome to the On My Coast podcast, where we share the stories of people on America's coasts whose experiences and challenges have inspired and been the focus of Sea Grant's work for over 50 years. I'm Amara Davis.
And I'm Hallie Meltzer. The National Sea Grant College Program, or Sea Grant, is a federal university partnership program that brings science together with communities for solutions that work. It was originally created through an act of Congress in 1966, and the state and national Sea Grant programs work together with community partners to create and maintain a healthy coastal environment and economy.
These stories are relevant because they show the important and necessary work that can happen through diverse, inclusive collaborations.
In this episode of On My Coast, we'll be connecting with a traditional ecological knowledge holder about their experiences and what it means to respectfully share knowledge.
My full name is Sabra Marie Kalchief Comet. I'm a member of the Osage Nation, and I am a second generation born in California Osage. I am currently the Coastal Training Program Coordinator at the South Slough National Estuarine Research Reserve, and I was a Maloof Scholar and a Knaus Fellow through Oregon Sea Grant that took me over to Washington, D.C. before my current position.
Traditional ecological knowledge is a knowledge system or worldview of human-environment relations that incorporates spirituality, cultural values, ethics, and the basic norms of society, and is passed down through generations, often through oral tradition.
My father worked for a tribe when I was growing up in the Northern California area, and through not on purpose, but I ended up going a similar route. Before grad school, I worked for a different tribe in Northern California, the Trinidad Rancheria, which is the southernmost Yurok affiliate. And during grad school, I had the opportunity to work with the Oregon coastal tribes, the Confederated Tribes of the Coos, Loramqua, and Siusla, the Coquel tribe, both of which the Nair that I now work with regularly. I also worked with I had conversations with the Grand Ronde tribe, and I also worked with the Siletz tribe on a project that was asking questions around how marine protected areas and other sorts of restricted take or restricted use areas on the coast were affecting tribal members, as well as if they had recommendations for how to manage the marine protected areas, the state controlled ones. And this was done in the form of long answer interviews to where I tried to make it as conversational as possible to allow the stories to flow naturally. And instead of question, answer, it was more of here's the overall view, but a lot of really valuable stories came out of that. Not only was there a management port generated for the marine protected areas, but all the original audio files, as well as the spatial files that were generated when people would mark on Google Maps what they were talking about, all of those went back to each of their member tribal governments to use for their own management, oral history, cultural uses. And I learned a lot about the area that I was somewhat familiar with, you know, living in Oregon for quite a few years, but I got to see it through a whole different lens. I got to know a lot more about the history, about the human footprint that had sculpted some of these very natural resource diverse areas, and really gave me a lot of context for how the relations are right now, how policies affect tribal members. And since I then went on to do more of a policy-focused fellowship through the Knaus, it really helped set me up for seeing how these really broad, overarching laws and policies can affect people on the ground level.
Traditional knowledge often emphasizes interconnectedness between people and nature. Traditional knowledge and knowledge gained via modern Western scientific methods are different and often complementary and parallel ways of knowing. However, integrating multiple ways of knowing fosters a more holistic practice of science.
The real value here is twofold, one of which is some of this information predated the technology. So like fish counts or sonar or anything that you would use nowadays to track these kinds of things. So the people were there way beforehand and they could point that out. So having a much earlier baseline data set is very valuable. And also, people are built to recognize patterns. Oral histories and people's mental timelines or people's noticing of patterns can be analyzed quantitatively, not just qualitatively. If they noticed any booms or busts in any of the populations, say if, you know, a particular clam had disappeared from an area or anything like that, as well as if they remembered any significant habitat or weather changes around the same time. If you ask someone to think back, they can spot patterns really well, and that's something that technology isn't necessarily great at. And it's very valuable information, especially when you can look pre-water level counters and then up to present day. If you have someone that is familiar with the area through that whole period, they can probably figure out a pattern that we wouldn't be able to get otherwise. But the one thing that I definitely still talk a lot about is how to analyze these oral histories in a quantitative fashion, which isn't always easy for career academics to visualize. And then I've definitely been trying to push some projects to adapt this style to where, yes, you take this information, you can group it this way into a quantitative sheet and then spit out, you know, these general patterns and trends and not just keeping it to qualitative analysis. And I think that's one thing that is very exciting to a lot of folks.
Traditional ecological knowledge both comes from communities and contributes to community identity. There are knowledge holders in every community, and this knowledge is integral to the way individuals connect with each other and with the environment around them.
Something that really resonated, especially when I started looking more at a policy focus, this was like, okay, so we really need to make sure that we build in these practices so that they'll be viable long into the future, accommodating for a better understanding of these places, the other changes that might be coming into them, but also knowing that there might be some sacrifice in the short term. Going back to fishing, there might be some sacrifice for catch limits for the first couple of years in order to let these populations bounce back. And knowing that it's not always a nice conversation with the folks that depend on that for their livelihood, but knowing when to take a firm stance and trying to, again, it's, you can never truly be in another person's shoes, but you can at least try to empathize with them. I definitely noticed that within my generation, there's more and more Native scientists coming out that, you know, go to college, get the hard science degrees, and have an understanding of that academic viewpoint, and then are either going back to their own communities or just working with Indigenous communities in general. As you have more young people able to have a foot in each one of these worlds, being able to be the bridge back and forth, I think that that's one of the big catalysts for these changes and for really bringing up the importance of TLEK in management and policy and science. But one of the other things that I want to definitely bring up is with, and again, just speaking that same generation, with these people that are going to college and then either coming back, or if they can't come back, then they, or like me, a transplant, but are working still within the broader community, is the struggles of keeping a firm root in that traditional life. it's a lot harder to find jobs near these indigenous communities, which are usually in rural areas. And with that comes the danger of losing these practices or this knowledge. And I haven't really heard a good solution yet. It's something that a lot of people are worried about. And it's not that there's a lack of interest from the younger generation. In fact, a lot of them go to extreme lengths to try and keep those connections. But with the way that a lot of people have to, they have to go to cities in order to make money to be able to support themselves, it's becoming a harder thing to maintain. But I think having a bigger network is really going to be key to make sure that individuals don't get burned out, that they don't take on more than they feel comfortable with, and to make sure that we keep a diversity of perspectives going. Because that's a really big part of it, is you don't want bottlenecks of information. You definitely want to have as diverse of viewpoints, ways of learning and understanding, and experiences as much as possible.
Putting complementary collaborative ways of knowing into practice is important and requires us to consider the customs and cultures, families and histories intertwined with this knowledge. We need to think about how we can move forward together in a way that respects the intricacies of this work.
So part of it is going through the process of relationship building, which is the direction that I see a lot of tribal communities wanting to go when working with external groups. They want time to build a relationship with someone and that person to understand more of the context of why certain things are not made public, of why this type of information is important, and to share really the lens through which this knowledge needs to be seen rather than the mainstream American perspective. But it's something that one isn't really known for people in different government agencies that want to work with tribal or indigenous communities. And it's the grant system and the funding system. A lot of time really isn't set up to host that kind of long-term relationship. If you have funding only for 2 years and you need to have a certain set of deliverables within those 2 years, it can be really hard to really get that relationship going and solidify it in a way that then both parties feel comfortable proceeding. And I think that needs to change.
We need to make room for a diversity of perspectives.
I think it's extremely important to have, again, not only be in a room with your peers, but also be in a room with a diversity of people in there. Making sure that when we're trying to get these diverse groups together, you know, when you want to have a thorough discussion with people, is not making sure that they're the token person to check that checkbox. Even if it's not everyone is represented, the fact that you have a diversity of people represented, I think makes everyone a little bit more comfortable and more willing to share.
We all come into this space from different places and different points on our journey. As long as we continue to move forward with each other with respect and understanding, we can make learning and knowing a more inclusive process.
Thank you at home for listening to this episode of the On My Coast podcast. We look forward to having you with us again as we continue to tell the stories of Sea Grant and the communities it serves.
If you'd like to hear more from us, please like, share, and subscribe to our podcast. And follow us on Instagram at @SeaGrant_Noah, Twitter at Sea Grant, and on our Facebook page, National Sea Grant College Program. We're your hosts, Amara Davis and Hallie Meltzer. And on our coasts, salty seas sustain ways of life,
feed many cultures,
and give better seasoned fish.